Kanapa Center, and I'm glad to see a few unfamiliar faces here. We want to welcome Jonathan Landau. He is a teacher with the FPMT, teaches at Land of Medicine Buddha, is that right? Discovering Buddhism occasionally at Land of Medicine Buddha. He met Lama Yeshe in 1970, so he has been studying and practicing for a long time. John is going to be here for 2 weeks. He will be teaching tomorrow night on the foundation of all good qualities, which is a foundational text in our lineage. This weekend he's going to be teaching a 3-day weekend workshop on the 7-point mind training, which is a text that's a set of instructions for how to be happy by practicing the altruistic mind. Then next week, on Monday night, he'll be teaching the first session in the Discovering Buddhism class on how to meditate. Once again, he'll be teaching on Wednesday on the foundation of all good qualities. Then on Thursday, he'll give a presentation on making pilgrimage to Buddhist holy sites, which I'm really looking forward to. And then on Saturday of next week, he will be giving a presentation on the life of Shakyamuni Buddha. So I hope that you can come to a lot of his sessions. He's very knowledgeable. I had a wonderful conversation with him. I just called him to get little thumbnails to explain the different classes, and we had a wonderful hour and a half Dharma discussion. It was very inspiring, and I found already Sunday to be also inspiring. Just a reminder that everything that we offer at Kanapa Center is offered on a donation basis. So if you are moved from your hearts by what you hear at any time during John's visit, we would be very happy if you felt the desire to put that into a material form in the form of donations. There are boxes right outside the Gampa here, and you can also donate by credit card online or in the bookstore. And with no further ado, we welcome Jonathan Landau.
Thank you, Donna, and thank you, everyone, for coming this evening. And if you're comfortable where you are, that's fine, but there are seats closer if you'd be more comfortable that way, you can always move up. So my idea is to make this presentation focusing on symbolism in Buddhist art, specifically Tibetan Buddhist art, though much of the symbolism covers Buddhism as a whole. And then if I don't talk too much, then I'm going to leave time over at the end for questions, and you can ask questions about any of the things that are presented on in the show itself, or anything else that has to do with symbolism. I can't guarantee that I can answer all your questions, even about this presentation. But if you ask a question I can't answer, I won't waste our time. I'll just tell you I can't, and then we'll move on to the next one. Okay.
Can I step quickly? When we have questions, we are streaming this, so please wait till you get a microphone so that the people listening on streaming can hear you. Thank you. Sorry.
Okay. All right. This may sound like a funny thing to say, but sometimes in situations like this, people have a question even before there's a presentation. Is that the case here? Is anyone coming with a burning question already? No? Okay. It sometimes happens. So I just wanted to double check. All right. So this is, of course, the symbolism in Buddhist art, and specifically focusing, the majority of this presentation is focusing on that aspect of the Buddhist teachings that deal with the Bodhisattva path. And we'll explain that as we go along. So all of the teachings derive from the figure, the historical figure, often known as Shakyamuni Buddha, who lived 2,500 years ago in India. And one of the later presentations we'll be focusing on his life story of how he began as a prince, how he left the royal way of life, and so forth. But for now, I would just say that he is the fountain of the teachings that we refer to as Buddhism. Now, he himself never referred to his own teachings as Buddhism. That was a term that was applied later. His teachings were he referred to as Dharma. Dharma, that which keeps us, holds us back from suffering. So it's the path leading to fulfillment. So sometimes his teachings is known as the Buddha Dharma. But nowadays, and for the past several hundred years, it's been generally referred to as Buddhism. And in the teachings of the Buddha, we can discern two integrated paths. The first one is the path that leads to personal liberation, freedom from one's anxieties, sufferings, dissatisfactions, and so forth. And the second one, which is based on the first, which is the path that leads to complete enlightenment. Or to put it another way, the first path leads to the lesser nirvana, and the second to the greater nirvana. We'll talk about more of that later. So both of these strands of teaching derive from the Buddha, and the main focus here will be, after saying a few words about the path to personal liberation, most of the rest will be about the path to complete enlightenment, which is the bodhisattva path. The bodhisattva being the compassionate being who wants to achieve full enlightenment so as best to be able to help and serve others. So the Buddha's first teaching that he ever gave was after his attainment of enlightenment when he was 35 years old. And he gave it to five of his former companions at a place called the Deer Park in Sarnath. And so this picture shows Buddha seated with those five companions giving his first discourse or sutra. And the sutra is known as the Sutra of Turning the Wheel of Dharma. In other words, instituting the teachings. And already you can see some symbolism present. The way the Buddha is holding his hands, this gesture or mudra is the mudra of teaching. I've heard it explained that holding a hand like this is kind of symbolic of turning the wheel, setting into motion the wheel of the teachings. And so sometimes the teaching mudra is just one hand raised like this. Sometimes it's two, and you'll see both of them represented in Buddhist art. So at that time, at that first teaching, Buddha gave, he introduced the idea of the Four Noble Truths. That phrase, Four Noble Truths, is that familiar to anyone here? Is it not familiar to anyone here? Four Noble Truths. Oh, everyone has heard of them. Good. All right, what are they? What's the first Noble Truth?
Suffering exists.
Yeah, there is suffering. The second one?
Has causes to suffer.
The suffering has a cause. The third one?
There's a way to end
it. Yes. Yeah, so the third one is that there is a cessation of suffering that can be attained. And then the fourth one is the path that leads to that attainment. Now, in that first teaching, he mentioned all four of them. And when he reached the last one, the fourth, he just simply mentioned the eight elements that make up the path that leads to the end of suffering. So this is known as the Eightfold Noble Path, or Noble Eightfold Path, and is often translated as right view, right intention, right speech, right action, right livelihood, right effort, right mindfulness, and right concentration. Now, it's kind of interesting. In the Tibetan, in some of the Buddhist traditions, there's a lot of teachings based on this division into eight, going all the way back to the very first teaching that the Buddha gave. It does exist in Tibetan Buddhism as well, but those of you who are familiar with the Tibetan Buddhist teachings are probably more familiar with these eight when they're divided into three categories. So the first two, right view and right intention, is the training in wisdom. Then the next three, right speech, right action, and right livelihood, is the training in ethical discipline. And the last two, right mindfulness and right concentration, is the training in higher concentration. So if you have been studying with Tibetan masters, you've probably heard about those three higher trainings of moral discipline, concentration, and wisdom. And that's just another way of referring to this eightfold path. I actually find it easier because I can memorize a list of three easier than I can memorize a list of eight. So, each major spiritual tradition in the world has its own identifying symbol, such as the double triangle in Judaism, or the cross in Christianity, or the gate in Shinto. All of these different symbols refer to that, each of its own spiritual tradition. Well, in Buddhism, that is represented by this wheel having eight spokes. And the reason for the eight spokes is because that's the noble eightfold path, which embodies the teachings of the Buddhism, the fundamental teachings of the Buddhism, of Buddha. So if you see outside of a monastery or a temple or elsewhere, you'll often see a wheel like this represented as a sculpture or as a painting. And very often, this wheel is flanked by two deer. And the reason for that is as a reminder of where the first teaching was given, in the deer park in Sarnath. And by the way, one of the later presentations I'll be making while I'm here at Kadampa is of a pilgrimage to some of the major Buddhist pilgrimage sites, and it will include visits to Sarnath or the deer park. So you get some sense of what it's like to visit these places 2,500 years after the time of Buddha. So here is just a summary of those three higher trainings that subsume the eightfold noble path. Now, one of those trainings was a training in higher concentration, how to calm and focus the mind. And this illustration here, which, by the way, many of you may know, is also out in the hall. There's a version that was painted, I was told, by the same person who decorated the stupa, which is here so you can get a closer look at it. And this path with a monk chasing an elephant and a monkey, and as they move along the path, the colors of these animals change, and all of this represents the stages, the nine stages of the mental development that we can go through when we train our mind so that it's no longer subject to distraction and haziness and lethargy, but becomes a laser-like instrument that we can use to penetrate into whatever it is that we're focusing on. So here, and there are teachings which talk about, which give a detailed explanation of what each of the twists and turns of this road to full mental focus, what it's all about. But here I'm just going to show you that this is another use of symbolism to illustrate the quality illustrates some aspect of the teaching, and mostly focusing on the training in higher concentration. But there's also elements, and this one right outside the door of this gompa, there's also a representation of this picture, sometimes referred to as the Wheel of Life. And this is largely illustrates the teachings on wisdom. The Four Noble Truths, starting with suffering, its cause, its cessation, and the path leading to it, is a general explanation of how we create dissatisfaction for ourselves and how we can overcome it. And then after giving this general introduction, then Buddha gave more detailed teachings on the mechanism that that if we don't do anything about perpetuates our suffering and dissatisfaction, but if we know how to deal with it, can break through that cycle, that vicious cycle of moving from one unsatisfactory situation to another. And so the Wheel of Life illustrates that. And actually, to give a reasonable explanation of this Wheel of Life would take a very, very long time because it's packed with tons and tons of teachings. But I just want to point out one or two things briefly. One, it's called the Wheel of Life, and if you look at the major segments in it, you'll see beings experiencing all different types of life situations, from those beings who are intoxicated with pleasure to those who are completely overwhelmed with mental and physical pain and suffering. And this is a summary of the different types of experience we can have before we achieve liberation or enlightenment. So it's actually a map of our own situation. If we look into our mind, we find at different points of our existence, we're experiencing something similar to everything that's represented here. And we can move back and forth between them rather rapidly. Then the mechanism from going from one, how we perpetuate these various levels of samsaric or unsatisfactory existence, that mechanism is indicated around the rim of the wheel here. And if you look carefully, you can see it's divided into 12 segments. So this illustrates the teaching known as the 12 links of dependent arising, which is the one of the major teachings of the Buddha, and it gives us an understanding of how things happen to us for reasons, for causes that we ourselves create. And if we want to break free from this cycle of unsatisfactory existence, then we have to apply the various antidotes to these to this circle of 12 links. Now, this whole picture is sometimes referred to as the Wheel of Life, but more accurately, I think it should be the Wheel of Unenlightened or Unliberated or Unsatisfactory Life, because there is another way of living. It's not as if what's shown here is the only is a picture of existence per se. It's a picture of unenlightened, trapped existence. And there is another existence possible, and that's symbolized up in the corners. Up in the right-hand corner, pointing away from this Wheel of Life, is the Buddha, and he's pointing to the moon. And here, the moon symbolizes the state of liberation or freedom. So he's indicating we may currently be trapped in this wheel of unsatisfactory existence, but there's another way of being. So I like to stress that point because Buddhism has in the past, I don't think so much anymore, but it has in the past had a reputation for being a very pessimistic spiritual tradition, people say, okay, what are the Four Noble Truths? Suffering? That's the first one? Forget it. Right? Or they see a picture of the Wheel of Life. This is supposed to represent life. And they look closely at what's going on in those various realms, what's going on in our mind, and we see greater or lesser experiences of suffering and dissatisfaction. So it's very important for us to know and to be reminded of the fact that this is what we can gain freedom from. And there is a method, and the method is taught in many different spiritual traditions. And in this one, those teachings come all the way back from Shakyamuni Buddha and indicate a state of liberation or enlightenment. Yes, please.
Is it Yama holding the wheel?
Oh, the figure that's holding this Wheel of Life is sometimes referred to as a Yama, or it was like a personification of death. Sometimes it's identified with that. Because one can move from one realm of experience after death. You know, we live in one realm and die, and we can be reborn in any of the other realms. So sometimes that figure is said to be Yama, the personification of death. Another way is just simply this figure represents impermanence, that there's no state of existence within this wheel, within samsara, this wheel of unsatisfactory existence. There's no state, no matter how high it is or how low it is, that's permanent. Right? Once the causes for creating that experience has been exhausted, then that realm comes to an end for the person experiencing it, and then they move through the force of their karma, through their actions, to another realm. So we can think of the figure that's holding it as Yama, the Lord of Death, or simply as impermanence. Okay. Oh, the one thing I did want to point out is right at the very, very center of the wheel is you find these three animals. And here you have a pig, and from the mouth of the pig is coming two other animals, a snake and some fowl. Sometimes it's identified as a rooster or a pigeon. Okay? And obviously these are all symbolic. And in this case, the rooster and the snake represent the two major afflictions or delusions which perpetuate our suffering and dissatisfaction. So the snake represents anger, hatred, and the rooster represents a desirous attachment. And these two attitudes, when they arise in our mind, they disturb whatever peace had been there before, and they impel us to engage in harmful actions which create suffering not only for other people, but for ourselves as well. So the snake of hatred and the bird of desirous attachment, they are the main active delusions or afflictions keeping us trapped in suffering. But where do they come from? Well, both of them derive from a misknowing of the nature of reality, what's sometimes simply referred to as ignorance. And the pig is here as a symbol of that ignorance, which actually is kind of, if the pigs have an anti-defamation league, then they might be a little bit upset with the Buddhists on this score, because pigs are actually quite, as far as mammals are concerned, pigs have quite a bit of intelligence. But I think they use the pig as an example for ignorance, maybe because of its habit of cooling itself by rolling around in the mud. And maybe that gives people the idea that it's somehow or other debased or ignorant, though in fact is quite intelligent. But anyway, these are just symbols, obviously. And both the bird and the snake, both desirous attachment on one hand and fearful and anger, repulsion or hatred on the other, derive from this ignorant view of holding on to an apparently solid and separate self-identity. It's in order to maintain and promote that identity that we repel those things that we don't like and become attached to those things that we do like, causing harm to others and to ourselves and perpetuating unsatisfactory existence. So that lies at the very, very heart of this wheel of life. And the vast majority of the Buddhist teachings are aimed at uprooting these three delusions so that we can break free from their influence. And those beings who put the Buddhist teachings on the Eightfold Path and the Four Noble Truths and the 12 Links of Dependent Arising, those beings who put those practices into action and follow through to the very end to achieve that liberation, they achieve I forgot about this. This just summarizes those three root delusions I was telling you about before. Greed or desirous attachment, that was the bird. Hatred or fearful repulsion, that was the snake. And self-grasping ignorance. But those who are able to uproot these afflictions achieve a state known as an arhat. An arhat is, that term arhat, it comes from an ancient Indian language, and it's often said to have the meaning of a foe destroyer. A foe destroyer. But in this case, the foe is nothing external to us. In Buddhist point of view, our enemies are not external to us, our real enemies. Our real enemies are those states of mind which keep us trapped in unsatisfactory states of existence. So the foe that's destroyed by a foe destroyer, or an arhat, are those afflictions, those delusions. And specifically the root delusion, that is the ignorance, the ego-grasping, self-grasping ignorance. An arhat is someone who has achieved the goal of complete cessation of suffering. Once one removes those delusions completely from the mind, then one no longer experiences suffering because one is no longer creating the causes for it. One achieves that state of being an arhat or a foe destroyer. That's also called the attainment of personal liberation. Personal here to emphasize that we're referring fundamentally to our own individual liberation from suffering, and that is called nirvana. Or to differentiate it from the higher attainment, sometimes it's referred to as the lower nirvana. And so that attainment of arhatship, of being a foe destroyer, that's also symbolized in art. This particular picture doesn't come from the Tibetan tradition. Most of my other images do, but this comes from a Chinese tradition, one of the great arhats, and you can see, even from this picture, some quality of an arhat, completely, all of his senses have been calmed and guarded. He's in a state of calm repose, not easily ruffled by anything. So it's a very powerful attainment, this cessation of suffering, this attainment of nirvana. And the peace and balance and serenity of this figure symbolizes those attainments. But the arhat is only one of the major symbolic figures indicating what can be attained through putting the Buddhist teachings into practice. One can attain the state of a higher arhat the Buddha himself, a Buddha himself, since there is the historical Buddha, Shakyamuni, shown here, but according to his teachings, we all have the Buddha nature within us, so we can all attain the same state of enlightenment that he did. And those beings who are interested in attaining that quality, that kind of radiant, loving, compassionate quality, they enter into the path known as the Bodhisattva path. And here we have, you know, the figure who is so instrumentally close to Kadampa Center, Kepche Zopa Rinpoche, and you'll see in this, his hands again are in the teaching mudra that I mentioned before of the Buddha in the Deer Park in Sarnath. So from the point of view of this path, this Mahayana path or Bodhisattva path, all beings have the Buddha nature, meaning the potential to attain the same full enlightenment that the Buddha himself attained. And so that is sometimes symbolically represented by showing the a Buddha image in one's heart. So now we're starting to talk about, instead of the arhat ideal, the bodhisattva ideal. Okay? So what is a bodhisattva? A bodhisattva is an enlightenment-bound being. In other words, a being who's not satisfied with attaining personal liberation from suffering, but wants to attain more than that, wants to attain a state in which he or she can be of maximum benefit to others. So that phrase, enlightenment-bound being, is found in the word bodhisattva itself. Because sattva, the last syllables, simply means a being, a person. And bodhi, as in the expression bodhi tree, means enlightenment, the state of a Buddha. So a bodhisattva is not a being who has attained enlightenment as much as he or she is a being who's striving for enlightenment for the sake of others. Now, there are beings who have attained full enlightenment who nevertheless appear as bodhisattvas to show others how to follow the path. But generally speaking, when we use the term bodhisattva, we're talking about someone who's on the path to enlightenment or aspires or has great admiration for the path that leads not just to his or her own liberation, but to the welfare, a state in which we can work towards the welfare of all beings. In the texts of the Pali Canon, the term bodhisattva appears many times because it's the term that's used for the being who became the Buddha, who attained enlightenment under the Bodhi tree. So it's to differentiate him from, to talk about him while he himself was still on the path that eventually led to his attainment of enlightenment, the Pali Canon refers to him as a bodhisattva. Now in the Mahayana teachings, the bodhisattva is used as a term for anyone who's striving to achieve enlightenment. In other words, it's not used solely for the past lives of Buddha Shakyamuni Buddha. So we have the enlightenment-bound being who is motivated by the compassionate bodhicitta motivation. So again, bodhicitta, citta means attitude or mind or motivation. Again, the attitude, mind, the motivation, the wish to attain bodhi, enlightenment. Why? Because it's the best possible state for benefiting others. So it's all focused on compassion. So wishing to attain enlightenment for the sake of benefiting others, that's the hallmark of the bodhisattva path, of the Mahayana path. And anyone who has cultivated this wish, this compassionate intention, is sometimes referred to as the son or the daughter of the Buddhas. And it helps explain quite a bit of the symbolism that we see in Buddhist art. As some background, many of the figures that are shown to be bodhisattvas, who represent this bodhisattva path, are dressed in the garments of Indian royalty. That's not the case with arhats. Arhats are not usually shown with silken garments or ornaments or long hair or any of the traditional signs of Indian royalty. Usually they're dressed more like renunciates, you know, like the robes of a monk or a nun, more like that. But bodhisattvas very often are represented wearing these garments that are appropriate to a prince or a princess. Right? So why? Why are they dressed that way? This is to indicate that just as a royal prince or princess has the destiny to grow up and become the monarch, become a king or a queen, so a bodhisattva, when his or her spiritual path matures, becomes a Buddha. So the Buddha is likened to the king, and his son and daughter is likened to the prince or princess who's emulating the path that will lead to the attainment of that kingship. So instead of being shown in these kinds of renunciate robes of an arhat, a bodhisattva very often, though not always, is shown wearing the robes of royalty. So here you see in this, this is also a very, very beautiful work of art from the Chinese tradition. If you look carefully, you can see that this figure, which represents compassion, is adorned with jeweled ornaments, flowing silken robes, long hair tied up in a knot, and therefore is shown, is identified as a bodhisattva because he's wearing these robes, which indicates that he's the son of the Buddha, that he's to grow up to be a Buddha. There's two questions. Yes, Wendy?
The posture is called the posture of royal ease.
And the posture is called the posture of royal ease.
Yeah, so that's also a connection with that idea of royalty. And there's another comment or question?
If Buddha left kingdom, he renunciated, right? So how come bodhisattvas want to be kings?
They don't want to be a royal king. They want to be a spiritual king.
But they don't have to dress as kings.
No, this is all symbolic. This is all symbolic. You don't see bodhisattvas walking around wearing silken robes and long hair and that. This indicates that these figures, right, are the son or the daughter who will grow up to be the king here, meaning the king, not a temporal king, you know, not a royal king, but a king who's gained control over his own mind and has developed all the qualities that enables him or her to benefit others. So all of these, remember, all of these are symbolic. You know, you could have a bodhisattva. In fact, we do. We do definitely have great high-level bodhisattvas who are dressed as fully renounced monks. Right? But if we could look inside their mind, right, they have all of these attributes of a bodhisattva. Does that make sense? Or is it still not clear?
It does, but I think I see there's attachment in bodhisattva to become Buddha. You know? Do you see?
Oh, an attachment. Ah, that's a very loaded word in Buddhism, attachment. Because generally speaking, in Buddhism, when the word attachment comes up, it's a negative. The same thing for desire. Sometimes desirous attachment. But in the teachings, if you check up carefully, they say not all desires are negative. The desire to become a Buddha so that you can help others is anything but a delusion. Ordinary desires, ordinary attachments are self referential, right? Like the ordinary, you know, run-of-the-mill romantic attachment between two people. It's like, I'll love you if you love me back, if you're nice to me. So even though it looks like the attachment is based on the wish to make the other person happy, if you check up carefully, most of it is wanting oneself to be happy. And if the partner ceases to make you happy anymore, then you find a new partner, right? So that is samsaric attachment. That's samsaric desire. And that is a negativity, right? True love, true compassion, is an attitude that anyone can develop. And when we develop, our wish is not that we receive something from the other person, but that we work for the happiness of the other person. So it's not a self-oriented, desirous attachment, even though sometimes it can be mixed with some elements of that. It's truly a wish to benefit others. So in that case, if you were to say, if you talk about a bodhisattva's desire to attain enlightenment, if it is a pure bodhisattva's desire, it's not so that I want to attain enlightenment because I've heard it's such a blissful state and I want to bliss out. It's not that. It's enlightenment is a state in which I can be of maximum benefit to others and I want to help others. So in that case, it's a desire or an attachment, if you want to use that term, which is not a delusion at all. In fact, it's absolutely necessary, because without desiring liberation or enlightenment, there's no spiritual movement. One just stagnates in whatever situation one is in. Is that helpful at all?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. I'm really curious about the appearance, especially in the sanghas, the art, of the different Buddhism. Why the androgynous look to them?
Okay, I'll get to that, especially when we talk about compassion. I'm going to stop the questions right now, okay? Because I can see that if it doesn't stop now, by the time 8:30 rolls around, I will not have completed any of this presentation, okay? So unless the question is a really burning one, you know, why don't we save the questions till the end? Is that okay? Yeah? If it's absolutely burning, you can ask. I might not answer. So, the aim then of a bodhisattva is to attain the state of a Buddha, which is symbolized by this figure here, Shakyamuni Buddha, seated on a specially prepared throne, holding a begging bowl, and his right hand is in the earth-touching posture. If you know something about the story of Buddha, and if you don't, we'll be going over the story of Buddha later on at some future date here. The right hand touching the earth is a symbol of the defeat of the forces of interference. But what I specifically want to focus on is the seat on which Buddha is seated, because the seat represents the path that the bodhisattva follows in order to attain enlightenment. So the first element in the seat is the lotus. And the lotus is a ubiquitous symbol in Buddhism, and it's actually used to symbolize many, many different facets of the spiritual path. Here, in this particular case, it's used to symbolize renunciation. Now, renunciation is not the best word, but it is the most often used word to identify this fundamental quality, fundamental aspect of the spiritual path. And the reason the lotus is used, it's based on the way it grows. Lotuses invariably grow in swampy, muddy waters, but they grow in such a way that they lift themselves up above the surface of the mud, and when they open up, then the flower is immaculate, it's clean. So this idea of growing from the mud but being unstained by the mud symbolizes many aspects of the spiritual path, and particularly renunciation. The better term for renunciation, the more accurate term, would be definite emergence. But that's a bit of a clunky phrase, so people don't use it. But that's what it actually means. Definite emergence. Emergence out of the mud, out of the ordinary wheel of life fraught with suffering and dissatisfaction, moving from one unsatisfactory state to another, to move out of it definitely. In other words, making that definite commitment, that definite desire. I don't want to remain in this ordinary state of unsatisfactory existence. I want definitely to emerge from it. Definite emergence. So, as it's often said, renunciation. And so here is a picture indicating the different colored lotuses growing from muddy swamps, but unveiling themselves in this immaculate, colorful, very brilliant display. So the lotus seat is made up of three parts. So we've already talked about the lotus, which indicates renunciation. But it's the renunciation of suffering and its causes, which is very different from the way we ordinarily use renunciation, isn't it? You know, like there's people who follow a certain tradition where for the Lenten season they'll give up something, right? And what do they give up? They give up something they like, going to the movies, eating chocolate, whatever it might be, right? And then you'll say, what are you doing for this Lenten season? Well, I'm renouncing movies. I'm renouncing eating chocolate, okay? So there, renunciation is giving up something you like, okay? Here, renunciation is giving up suffering and the causes of suffering. So it's quite the opposite, has quite the opposite feeling, that we no longer wish to involve ourselves not only in suffering existence, but in the very causes of that suffering, which fundamentally come back down to desirous attachment, hatred, and ignorance, misunderstanding of the nature of reality. Okay? So the lotus represents that. Then on top of the lotus, there are two cushions presented. In some cases, only one cushion, but in some cases, there are two. And when there are two, very often, the sun, the cushion of the sun is on the bottom, and this, the brilliance of the sun, represents the wisdom perceiving the nature of reality. And then on top of that is a moon cushion, a white moon cushion, which represents this compassionate bodhicitta motivation, the wish to attain enlightenment to benefit others. So here you have what is sometimes known as the three principal aspects of the path that leads to enlightenment: renunciation, wisdom, and the bodhicitta, the compassionate bodhicitta motivation. And very, very often when lamas come to give teachings, for example, if His Holiness is invited someplace, and maybe he's been asked to give a tantric initiation, before giving these advanced teachings, he'll give a briefer teaching which covers the fundamental of the path leading to enlightenment. And very often the text that he'll choose is a text known as the three principal aspects of the path. And I just swiped this from the bookstore outside the door. This is one of the many texts which give a commentary on these three principal aspects of the path. So if it's something that you have not read or studied, it is very, you'll find it to be very, very helpful, a real true foundation to the spiritual path, these three principal aspects. And there are quite a number of different teachings that have been given which explain these three. So here's the lotus. So this is a close-up picture of what the Buddha was sitting on. So here's the lotus. And then on top of that is depicted the two cushions. Now, of course, you can only see the edge of the sun disk, right? Because most of it's obscured by the moon disk. However, for a meditator who's visualizing this, all the elements of the visualization are thought to be transparent. Right? So even if the moon is overlapping the sun and both of them are overlapping parts of the lotus, one can, in one's mind eye, see through them. Because there's nothing solid in any of these visualizations. But of course, if an artist has to paint, then it's difficult to paint everything being transparent. Maybe someday it will be possible to do that using holographic techniques or something. But when it comes to using paint pigments, it's very, very difficult to approximate. So that's the seat upon which a Buddha sits, meaning the three principal aspects of the path of renunciation, wisdom, and compassionate bodhicitta are the basic fundamental elements to be cultivated to attain the enlightenment of a Buddha. And then, with the attainment of enlightenment, or I'll start that again. Some people say, okay, enlightenment, that term is used a lot. Well, what does it mean? What does it refer to? How do we know? What's the criteria of enlightenment? Well, in the Buddhist tradition, enlightenment itself has three qualities that are generated to an unlimited or universal extent. And these three are compassion, which is the wish for others to be released from their suffering. And of course, the bodhicitta motivation is is based on such compassion. And wisdom, which is an understanding of the nature of reality. And then skillful means, knowing what is the best thing to do in any situation that has the best chance of bringing a positive, beneficial result. Now, the rest of this presentation focuses on three symbolic figures, or variations on three symbolic figures who represent these three qualities, the quality of compassion, wisdom, and skillful means. So the first is compassion, universal compassion, the wish for all beings to be freed from suffering. And there are a number of figures that represent compassion, but the main chief figure is Avalokiteshvara, or as it's known in Tibetan as Chenrezig. Avalokiteshvara, sometimes referred to as the Buddha of compassion, or sometimes referred to as the Bodhisattva of compassion, because compassion as the pathway leading to enlightenment and the qualities of a Buddha. So there are more than 100 different forms which Avalokiteshvara can take, but two are the main ones that we see reproduced all the time. One is the four-armed version of Avalokiteshvara. Four-armed, two arms, two hands pressed together, holding a wish-fulfilling gem. A wish-fulfilling gem is something out of Indian mythology. It's very much akin to Aladdin's lamp. It's something that if you find it, you can make a wish. And here, the wish is the wish for other beings to be freed from their suffering. So the fact that the Avalokiteshvara has such extraordinary compassion, part of that is symbolized that he's holding the wish-fulfilling jewel, which fulfills the wishes of beings to be released from their suffering. And then in his right hand, he's holding a rosary, a mala, as they would say in Sanskrit, And this indicates a reminder to recite the mantra, Om Mani Padme Hum, which is the mantra which embodies in sound the same compassionate intention that the Avalokiteshvara's figure embodies in color. And it also, each time we move a bead on the mala, then it can represent every individual being to whom we're generating these compassionate thoughts. May you be freed from suffering. May you be released from all suffering and dissatisfaction. So in his right hand he has such a mala, and then in his left hand there's another lotus again, symbolizing, as I said before, the lotus is an all-purpose symbol, and here it can be used just simply as a symbol of the bodhisattva's path. This lotus down here symbolizes renunciation. This lotus here can be thought of as symbolizing the compassionate movement of a bodhisattva who, even though he or she remains in ordinary existence as part of his or her activity to benefit others, the compassionate intention prevents that bodhisattva from being stained by the ordinary defilements of ordinary existence. Okay, so the lotus can be thought of as symbolizing that path, the bodhisattva path. A question was asked before of why so many of the figures have an androgynous face. And of all of them, it's generally speaking Avalokiteshvara, Chenrese, who has the face which sometimes we can't decide, is it male or female? And there is a reason for this, because in many cultures, if not most cultures, the compassion, softness, nurturing, is very often identified with a female, a mother figure. This is not to say that males can't be compassionate, but of the two, that's a quality which is more often than not associated with female. And something interesting happened. Actually, this is something that really piqued my attention well before I became a Buddhist, but I was a student in college and I was taking a course, and in that course the teacher said that he was surveying the movement of various Asian religions, and he said, in India, the figure that represented compassion was a male, Avalokiteshvara. But when Buddhism made its way to China, the Far East, they already had figures that were symbolic of compassion. These were kind of a certain kind of earth goddesses and so forth. And these were all female. So after a while, the same figure in Chinese was known as Kuan Yin, which was originally represented in male form, started to become represented in female form. So you have a case of a deity having a sex change operation, which I thought was amazing, that people would have such fluidity of mind that something that could be viewed either as male or female, because I came from a background in which the differentiation between male and female was something very hard and fast, whereas this kind, to my mind, showed a certain fluidity, a certain openness to being able to see these qualities represented either male or female. And of course, again, we're talking about symbolism. We're not saying that if Chenrese is a male, that only males are compassionate, or if Kuan Yin is shown as a female, that only females are compassionate. They all have a symbolic reference. And as my teacher, Lama Yeshe, said, we all have male and female energy within us, And through the practice of the spiritual path, we can learn how to integrate both of them. So here is Chen Reisig in his forearmed aspect, but also the other main figure of the many that there are of Chen Reisig, the other popular one, is the thousand-armed. So here you have Chen Reisig or Avalokiteshvara standing up, and he has the same four hands. Sorry, that's I think I
need to use the mouse and click off.
Click off the image? And then it'll work? Yeah, thank you. So if you look carefully, and it's hard because you'd have to get really close to be able to see all the detail, you'll see that the same four hands that were in the forearm version are here as well. Two holding wish-filling gem at the heart, a rosary in the right hand, and a lotus in the left. But in addition, there are four other major hands holding in a boon-granting gesture, holding a vase, holding a wheel, and a bow and arrow. So those are the first eight major hands. And then there are 992 other hands reaching out in every direction, and on the palm of each hand is an eye. So here the idea is that universal compassion doesn't leave out anyone. It reaches out in all directions. It sees and is sympathetic to the suffering that all beings are experiencing, and then reaches out, lends, we could say, a helping hand in every direction to the beings who are suffering. So this figure then has 1,000 arms. Also has 11 heads. And there is a story, a legend, again, a symbolic myth indicating how this 12-armed version came into existence. And according to this myth, Avalokiteshvara, in his ordinary form, ordinary here, meaning just one face and two arms, very ordinary form, was meditating deeply on compassion, thinking of the suffering situation of all beings, and reciting the mantra Om Mani Padme Hum hundreds and thousands of times, sending out these wishes to benefit others. And he was engaged in this practice for a long time, and he entered the practice with the wish, with a fierce determination. He said, if during my practice my thoughts turn only to my own welfare, may my head be split into 10 pieces and my body into 1,000. So it was just a very strong determination that he was going to work solely for the welfare of others. So he engaged in this long practice, many mantras, much meditation, for long periods of time. And then at the end, he rose from the meditation and he looked around to see what benefit he had created. And he saw that while he had benefited a small number of beings, there were so many more who were still sunk into suffering. And this caused him great anguish and great disappointment. And the thought arose in his mind, it's so hard to work for others. Maybe I just should work for my own welfare. And the minute that thought arose in his mind, because of that previous determination that he had made, then, because of the vow that he had made, his body cracked into 1,000 pieces and his head cracked into 10 pieces, filling him with incredible anguish and suffering. And he called out to his spiritual master, the Buddha Amitabha, who appeared. And Amitabha said, he said, every action is determined by the intention made at the time of that action and bears its fruit. What you're experiencing now is the fruit of your own action, your own determination. He said, but it is coming from a place of complete and utter selflessness and compassion. So using his power, the Buddha Amitabha transformed the broken bits of his body, these 1,000 parts, into 1,000 arms, making him more effective to be able to help others. And then the 10 pieces that his head cracked into became 10 heads, pointing in the different directions so that he could see beings in all the various realms. And then, as a sign of how proud he was of his own spiritual son for making this determination and giving him the inspiration to continue on his path, then he took a duplicate of his own head, of Amitabha's own head, and crowned Avalokiteshvara. So here, if you look closely, on the first level you have a central face being white, and then the right, his right, being green, and the left red, and then above that you have green, red, and white, and above that red, white, and green. So these different colors represent the different types of powers that one, or types of activity that one engages in to help others. There's activities which are peaceful, activities which are governing, and activities of increase. And the different colors represent those different activities. Then sometimes these more peaceful activities don't bring about the compassionate result that's desired. So sometimes we need a wrathful, a very strong force. And so above these first 9 heads, hard to see from where you're seated, there is a wrathful face of Mahakala, which we'll have more to say about in a moment, and then Amitabha's own face on the very top. So a meditator who is focusing on or visualizing the guru as being the 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, or if he's received an initiation, visualizing himself this way, then all of these elements of the iconography relate to the path and the determination of how to follow that path. So they all have this various levels of meaning, and so the image is like a mnemonic device. It's a memory device reminding us of the qualities of compassion. And so here, in our human world, a foremost manifestation of the Bodhisattva Avalokiteshvara is His Holiness the Dalai Lama, who's here seated in front of a statue of the 1,000-armed Chenrezig in Dharamsala, India, where he lives. Then there is an image, again, showing His Holiness the Dalai Lama, and in the upper, from his point of view, in the upper right is the four-armed Avalokiteshvara, indicating the strong connection he has with that figure. And the upper left is Lama Tsongkhapa, who we'll talk about a little later, who was the teacher of the very first Dalai Lama, about 600 years ago, something like that. And then on top of that, the fountain from which all the teachings came, Guru Shakyamuni Buddha. And one thing I want to point out, notice in this picture, the Dalai Lama is not seated on a lotus. He's on a cushion. This is an indication, whenever you see something like this, it's an indication that this work of art was painted when the main figure, in this case the Dalai Lama, was alive. When the teacher is alive, never shown on a lotus sun and moon seat. But after a figure like this passes away, which of course we hope won't be for a very long time, then you can show figures like Tsongkhapa passed away a long time ago, so they can show him on a lotus and moon seat. And then again, that kind of very quite sweet, almost motherly view that the world has starting to come to recognize as being specifically the embodiment of compassion. A close-up of another depiction of Avalokitesvara, also showing a somewhat androgynous view because compassion is such a soft quality. And of course, in the world spiritual tradition, Avalokiteshvara is not the only figure that represents this compassion. And the reason I include this picture of Jesus here is because there are many people from a Buddhist background, from a Christian background, who see the intimate interconnection between Avalokiteshvara on one hand and Jesus on the other. And among the people who see that connection is His Holiness the Dalai Lama. This picture was taken in a church in Austria, I believe. And you can tell by the way that the Dalai Lama is looking at this image of Jesus is that there's a deep recognition which goes way beyond any possible differences. We might think that one is coming from one religious tradition and the other is coming from a different one. That surface of these apparent differences, there is identity, and the Dalai Lama recognizes that very, very sharply. And I include this picture largely just because I love it. To me, the more I look at this picture, the more I see different things in it. But what strikes me most of all is this. What I can only call this motherly concern for the welfare of others. And having said that, then we can move into the female version of compassion, which is Tara, representing compassionate activity. And Tara, along with Chenrezig, these are two of the most beloved bodhisattvas in the Buddhist iconography, and both of them relate to compassion, whereas Chenrezig is predominantly the thought or the wish to benefit others. Tara takes that wish and puts it into action. In regards to that, there's a short story to tell about Lama Yeshe. Lama Yeshe was the one who originally founded centers of the FPMT organization, of which the Gadampa is one. He's the guru of Lama Zopa, who's the head of the FPMT now. And in the early days, when the centers were just starting up back in the 70s, it very, very often happened, it was almost uniform, that the directors that Lama Yeshe appointed to run each of these centers, more often than not, was a woman. And so, noticing that, someone once asked Lama, why is it that you always appoint women as the directors of your new centers? And I can still see Lama Yeshe answering this question. He said, why? He says, because women get things done. Like that. And that, to me, that's Tara energy. You know, Chenrezig meditates on compassion. Tara takes that and puts it into practice. So you have the Taras that saves from the eight fears, all the different forms and manifestations of Tara's energy. There are many different colored Taras. The two main ones are green and white, green indicating this activity, and white indicating longevity. I'm going to go a little faster through some of the remaining things because I see you haven't left too much time. So I'm going to go a little bit faster through these. This picture I'm including because it's from it's not from a Tibetan Buddhist tradition, but in Nepali, Nawari Buddhist tradition. And that little tilt to the head makes this figure of Tara so much more alive from my perspective. All the images of Tara are beautiful, but this one kind of gives it a living quality. And for me, it relates to Chondroma. How many people here have had the pleasure to have met Chondroma?
I never have met her.
You've never met her, okay. She is one of the most extraordinary beings on this planet. She has been benefiting His Holiness the Dalai Lama. She wouldn't say she's benefiting anyone, but she's called upon to help many high lamas, and for the past number of years, she's been a very, very close companion to Kabje Zopa Rinpoche. In fact, when Lama Zopa Rinpoche gave the aspect of experiencing a stroke a number of years ago, then it was Chondroma who was the one who supervised his medical treatment. And at that time, Lama Zopa used to refer to her as, she's my doctor. Right? And whenever he needs an observation as to what should be done to provide the most benefit, like where stupas should be placed, what kind of stupas they should be, and all kinds of decisions like that, he always checks with Chondroma. And he recognizes her as a manifestation of Guru Rinpoche's consort and of Tara. And when I saw her, the biggest impression I got was it was like a Tara statue coming to life. If you ever have the chance to be with Chondroma, you know, whenever she's around or whenever you can go to where she is, it's definitely well worth the visit, especially because as things have evolved, the vast majority of the teachers that we have in the Tibetan tradition up to this point have been males. So there are a few exceptions. So it's very nice to see the embodiment in a female form of someone who has all of these extraordinary, widely recognized qualities. But not always is it necessary to manifest in a peaceful aspect to benefit. You know, some situations require wrathful energy. It doesn't mean that the Buddha or the Bodhisattva is actually angry or hates someone, but it's like when a parent sees a child running out into the street. The parent will do or say anything to get the child out of that danger. Throw a rock at the child, yell at the child, scream, whatever. Not out of anger, but because something very powerful has to be done right away. So the same thing, you have images of Tara, which instead of the normal image of a very peaceful, loving, calm look, may even have a very, very powerful, a wrathful expression. And the same thing is true for Chenrezig. And here is what Mahakala, who is the wrathful form of compassion, looks like. This is like the head way up on the top of the thousand-armed Chenrezig. And you might wonder, well, if he's so compassionate, why is he so angry? Well, this anger is not directed at other beings. This anger is directed at all of those mental qualities which keep people trapped in suffering. And sometimes you need this powerful force to be able to dynamite those delusions. And so for that case, you have very powerful meditative practices like Mahakala. So both Amitabha, both Chenrezig and Tara belong to the lotus family of Amitabha, who I've mentioned before. So he is usually shown the color of the setting sun. And here is one artist's rendition of light. It's not completely transparent, but he was able to draw it in such a way that one could see the light emanation from Amitabha. And Amitabha, that name, means the Buddha of infinite light. So, we talked about that the quality of enlightenment, the enlightenment has three qualities. We mentioned compassion. The next one is wisdom, and the primary symbol of wisdom is Manjushri. And Manjushri is often shown having the attributes of holding a flaming sword of wisdom in his right hand, and you can't see it completely here, but a text of the perfection of wisdom. Those are the Buddhist teachings on the nature of reality. And so in this way, Manjushri represents this ability to use discriminating wisdom, the discrimination which sees correctly the difference between what should be practiced and what should be avoided, the way things exist and the mistaken way things don't exist. So the sword is kind of a symbol of that incisive mind which can make that proper distinction between what is right and what is wrong. And then the perfection of wisdom text contain the most profound teachings on that wisdom. Many of you are somewhat familiar with one of the shortest versions of the perfection of wisdom, and that's the Heart Sutra. But again, in some cases, it's necessary for this wisdom to take a very powerful form. So the wrathful form of Manjushri is known as Yamantaka or Dorji Jigje. And if you look very carefully, you'll see that he has several heads, and the topmost one is Manjushri. Right. So that perfection of wisdom that I mentioned before in Sanskrit is called Prajnaparamita, and there are various perfection of wisdom discourses or sutras, such as the Heart Sutra and the Diamond Sutra that I mentioned before. And these are very significant because in the Mahayana lineage, the lineage of the practice of the Bodhisattva, derives primarily from the perfection of wisdom discourses that the Buddha gave. And they combine two lineages. The lineage of compassionate method, what we've been talking about, primarily compassion, bodhicitta, and so forth, and the lineage of insightful wisdom. And Prajnaparamita, as the embodiment of this perfection of wisdom, is also symbolized by a female figure. So here you have the deity, or the bodhisattva, known as the perfection of wisdom, and she is shown in having four arms, two in meditation, one holding the dorje, which I'll talk about in a second, a symbol of power, and again that perfection of wisdom text. Now, the two implements which symbolize these two strands of teaching, the compassionate method and the insightful wisdom, the two implements which are very often used to symbolize this are presented here. The dorje, which the deity Prajnaparamita was holding in one of her right hands, this is a power symbol, and then the bell. In ancient Indian mythology, the kings of heaven, Indra in his right hand, held a thunderbolt. So Indra is like the equivalent of the Greek Zeus or the Roman Jupiter, who also holds a thunderbolt, a symbol of power. Yeah, or Thor. Right? So, sorry, my train of thought just got derailed, which happens very easily. So, the taking this symbol of power into the Buddhist tradition, now this didn't become like the power to overcome your enemy, but the power of compassion itself. So this powerful aspect then is symbolized by the Dorje, or the Vajra, as it's known in Sanskrit. And then the bell symbolizes wisdom. There is an explanation of why the bell symbolizes wisdom, but since we're reaching the end of our time here, I'm going to have to explain that another time. It's too detailed to just summarize clearly in one or two words. So, figures, various figures are shown to hold the Vajra, the Dorje in one hand, the right hand, and the bell in the left hand. And here, this particular figure is the Bodhisattva of purification, Vajrasattva. Sometimes shown embracing a female consort, and in that case, the male figure represents the compassionate method, and the female figure represents the insightful wisdom. Then it's checking back with Manjushri again, because the teacher of the first Dalai Lama, Lama Tsongkhapa, the founder of the tradition to which the Kadampa Center belongs, it was recognized as a manifestation of Manjushri. So when you see pictures of or statues of Tsongkhapa, you'll see that in his right hand he's holding a lotus which supports a sword, Manjushri's sword, and left hand a lotus which supports a perfection of wisdom text. So all of this kind of indicates that Lama Tsongkhapa is union oneness with Manjushri. And it's a very common practice for us to invoke Lama Tsongkhapa and his two major disciples. Behind me, there are statues showing this very clearly. So on his right hand is his senior student Geltsub Che, who is viewed as a manifestation of Chenrezig, Avalokiteshvara. And on his left-hand side is his junior disciple, Kedrup Che, who's shown to be a manifestation of Vajrapani. And then Tsongkhapa himself is said to be Manjushri. So you have these three figures together represent the three qualities of enlightenment, compassion, skillful means, and wisdom. And later, before you leave, you might want to come up and look at the statues behind me, because there the faces of the two disciples are differentiated, and Geltsub Che, the older one, has a very gentle expression of Avalokiteshvara, and Kedrup Che, the younger one, has a semi-wrathful expression of Vajrapani. But from where you're sitting, you probably can't see it, but afterwards, you can check it out. Then, it's a practice in Tibetan Buddhism to view one's own teacher as in union oneness with the head of the particular tradition. So here is a statue in the window of a stupa of Lama Yeshe, and he's holding, he's sitting in the posture of Lama Tsongkhapa, and again you have the sword of wisdom in the right hand and the text in the left. Then the last quality, and I'll go through this quite quickly because there's not that many images, is skillful means, the ability to enter in any situation and do what's ever necessary to benefit others. And so that's represented by Vajrapani, the holder of the diamond scepter. And he's one figure who's very, very often, but not always, shown in a wrathful form, because this, again, this isn't anger, this isn't hatred, this is power. So it's the power to benefit others, the ability to manifest in whichever way is necessary to help others. So this is the most commonly seen image, I believe, of Vajrapani, but there also exists a peaceful version. So here's the more peaceful version of Vajrapani. Again, the same deep blue color, but on this lotus is a Vajra, which is what both the peaceful and the wrathful Vajrapani are holding, the symbol of power. This is a close-up of a picture of that younger disciple of Tsongkhapa that I was mentioning before, Kedrupche, because here you see his expression has this kind of wrathful look, again, just to indicate the power of Vajrapani. And Lama Yeshe himself, for me, we see lots of pictures of Lama Yeshe smiling, because he did that a lot. But sometimes he could be very, very stern. And his expressions would change depending on many, many different situations, and especially his wish, his deep, passionate wish to be able to communicate with others. So the next pictures were taken at one teaching that he gave, and these pictures were taken one right after another to indicate the kind of dynamic, Vajrapani-like quality of Lama Yeshe. Sorry, this is acting up. Yeah. Then there's an image of the Lama showing all those three qualities with Manjushri at the crown, Avalokiteshvara at the throat, and Vajrapani at the heart. So here you have Lama Tsongkhapa, or our own guru, with the attributes of Manjushri, as always, and then Manjushri in the crown, Avalokiteshvara in the throat, Vajrapani in the heart. Then I indicated before that the jewelry that the bodhisattvas wear symbolize the various perfections of the bodhisattva. So this is one explanation, that the necklaces symbolize the perfection of giving or generosity, the bracelets, morality, the earrings, patience, the belt buckle, effort or enthusiastic perseverance, the crown, concentration, and the top jewel, wisdom. But sometimes you'll see them represented differently. So there, it's just a reminder of these different kinds of ornaments that some of the bodhisattvas are shown wearing. And then some last pictures of Lama Yeshe. Again, showing that compassionate, warm, motherly quality that he had. And very often it was very, very difficult for Lama to keep from laughing. He's so filled with that energy. So thank you, everyone. I didn't leave time for questions. I had hoped to. But if you don't mind, and if you have a burning question, I'm happy to stay here for another 5 or 10 minutes if you want something. Yes, over here.
Yes, Thank you. In Tibetan traditions, we call these images deities. Were Shinrizig or Tara or any of these deities at one time actual people, like Buddha was a real person at one time?
Yes, some of them have histories like that. For example, during the time that Shakyamuni Buddha was alive in India, he had many, many disciples, arhat disciples and bodhisattva disciples. And among them were the eight great bodhisattvas. And numbered among those eight great bodhisattvas was Avalokiteshvara and Manjushri and Vajrapani and Maitreya and a few others.
When did they get the extra arms?
That's all symbolic.
Okay.
You have to recognize all of this iconography symbolizes something. You know? Like the thousand arms symbolizes this reaching out in every direction. You don't actually have to have a thousand arms to do that. But it's that manifestation of that all-embracing wish to benefit others. I didn't call on you yet. There was another question I saw. No?
No.
I thought I saw a hand. Okay, Wendy, yeah.
Thank you. They're like blueprints for your meditation. They symbolize different qualities that you're meditating on. And so, although there was originally an historic person, when they become figures in iconography, they have additions to them that are to help you in your meditation practice. Qualities that you meditate on that help you develop those qualities within yourself. And then my question for you, John, is in some of the iconographies, some of the petals on the lotus seat go up and others go down. Once someone told me that those have special meaning, but I've never been able to find out what it is. Do you know?
I had never heard an explanation up until about 2 weeks ago when someone asked the same question, and I found an answer, not a definitive answer, but an answer in Robert Beer's encyclopedia. So you go there and you look under lotuses, it gives an explanation, but even in his explanation, which is the only one I ever come across, he couches it in terms like it can mean this, it can mean something else. So there's no, it's not like a one-to-one correspondence that every time the lotuses point up it means one thing and every time it points down it means another. But there are explanations which talk about that, but I think Robert Beer's book, I looked it up not too long ago, I think it's on page 92. You know, the big one. You know the encyclopedia by Robert Beer?
Which encyclopedia of what?
Of iconography? Well, check it out. It's a very, very huge volume. Yes?
I noticed that many of the thrones were supported by snow lions.
Yes.
And snow lions seem to be a really popular symbol. Can you just briefly discuss what that might be?
Yes, snow lions are, again, a kind of a mythological beast, meant to inhabit the high Himalayas. And they're symbols of power, like a lion, you know. And if one is doing the full visualization, then each corner of the throne is supported by two such snow lions. There's two in each corner. Of course, in a picture, you only see the first two. You can't see all eight of them, right? But in your meditation, apparently you're supposed to be able to do that. I can't do that, but you're supposed to be able to do that. And then each pair of snow lions, you'll see one is of the pairs looking up and the other is looking down. And this indicates that these lions are protecting against interferences coming from above and from below. So it's an all-embracing symbol of a protected space. So the space on which the Buddha is seated is protected in that way. It also, those four corners, in a very similar way, refer to the four fearlessnesses of a Buddha. And in the text you can discover that when the Buddha gives teachings, he is without fear that anything that he says can be contradicted. You know, he has complete conviction when he teaches something of the validity of it. And so I don't remember specifically the name of all four of the fearlessnesses, but that's what they represent as well. So you have this protected space in which fear cannot enter, and that's the space in which the Buddha sits. And of course that's the same space in which our own Buddha nature will manifest. Right? So we're not just talking about someone outside ourselves, but our own inner potential.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Compassion and wisdom, and
yeah,
the desire to free every sentient being from suffering is love.
Yeah.
Pure love.
Yeah.
Not the attachment love that...
No, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So, but it's not something that it's kind of like talked about when we're teaching or talking about this wisdom and enlightenment, and we talk about compassion and wisdom. Love is something that is medullary, and it's like a very strong, like the images that we were looking at today. Thank you.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely true. And if you look into the teachings for the cultivation of that bodhicitta motivation, you know, the very heart of the bodhisattva's path, and you see the stages that lead up to it, along the way, foundational to it, is the cultivation of love, this wish for others to be happy. And when you see that others aren't happy, that then transforms into compassion, the wish for them to be separated from their suffering. So very often to get the sense that these two are just two sides of the same coin, right? Sometimes they're referred to simply as loving compassion. Then that combines both of those qualities together, loving kindness, loving compassion. Then it has both the wish for others to be happy and the related wish for them to be separated from suffering. Yeah, very good. Thank you. Donna?
If there's time, I would be interested in hearing what you had to pass over about the bell, the symbolism of the bell.
Oh, okay. I didn't want to keep people too late because, you know, I don't know, maybe there's a ball game on tonight that you want to see. Why the bell symbolizes wisdom? When you ring a bell, the clapper hits the shell. And as a result of this dependent arising, this coming together of these two forces, a sound is produced, right, that we can discern. If you looked to find the sound, you can't actually find it in the shell, and you can't actually find it in the clapper. You can only find it in the coming together, in the dependent arising, the interaction of that clapper and the shell. So this serves as a symbol for the investigation of reality. You know, things appear to the unenlightened mind as if they exist as solid, separate, unrelated entities, like clapper and shell, right? But, you know, me, you, us, them, floor, ceiling, sun, moon, all the things that appear to us, to our senses and to our mind, appear until we have achieved liberation and enlightenment, they appear as if they have their own concrete self-identity. Well, one of the Buddha's deepest most radical teaching is that nothing has even one atom of such concrete self-existence, that everything is merely a dependent arising. And because things come together, effects are produced, but there are no self-existent phenomena. Right? So that lack of self-existence is indicated by the fact that you can produce a sound, but you can't find the sound in either of the two things that produced it. And yet, the sound is a phenomenon that you can relate to. So that's the Reader Digest version of a very profound analogy. I guess you could get a much easier one. I could have copped out, and I could say it just rings with the sound of wisdom. And then you could accept that as the expression. But it's not nearly as profound as this other explanation. Okay. So, anyway, you've been more patient than I deserve, but I'm glad to have met you, and maybe I'll see some of you at some of the other presentations on either the topics that we're going to discuss or the presentation of the life of Buddha and the pilgrimage through the various holy sites of India and Nepal. Okay? So, thank you very much. Thank you.